You're listening to Losing Myself, Mental Health in a Hostile Environment, a podcast brought to you by Migrants Organise. Throughout this series, we hope to shine a light on the realities of the UK's immigration and asylum system, explore the pressure and anguish it puts upon people who go through it, while also hearing about hopeful and powerful acts of migrants and community organising. Each episode will focus on a different aspect of the UK's asylum system. In today's episode, I spoke to Brian and Amy about the Migrants Mental Capacity Advocacy, or MMCA, project. Adults with severe mental health issues receive little support navigating the immigration and social welfare system, though they may lack the mental capacity to do so. As a result, many are unable to regularise their status and face the full brunt of the hostile environment. The project is the first and only one of its kind in the UK, offering direct support for people going through the legal system while organising for systemic change. Brian works for Migrants Organise and is one of the MMCA project's main organisers, while Amy is a litigation friend and otherwise works as a barrister. Hello, Brian and Amy. So today we're talking about the Migrants Mental Capacity Advocacy Project. Brian, would you be able to introduce the project for us?
Yes. So the Migrants Mental Capacity Advocacy Project, or MMCA project, is a strategic project at Migrants Organise where we offer ongoing and holistic support for migrants and asylum seekers in the UK who suffer from mental health issues, who might have difficulties with their mental capacity to engage with the immigration process. So we offer immigration and welfare advice that includes housing, access to mental health services or social care, for example. And then we use our experience to kind of raise awareness about this issue and engage in kind of policy and strategic legal work.
So when you talk about strategic legal work, what does that look like?
So, for example, at the moment, one of the issues that we've identified is that there is a lack of litigation friend of last resort for individuals who lack mental capacity to litigate in the immigration tribunal. So just to provide a bit of a context, mental capacity is a legal concept. It refers to a person's ability to make a particular decision. So if you think about an elderly person who suffers from dementia, for example, that person might well lack mental capacity to make decisions on certain things, for example, where they should live or what they should eat for the day. So that's mental capacity. And through the project, we assist individuals, as I said, with a lot of mental health issues who might not be able to understand or make decisions around their immigration process, whether that's claiming asylum or litigating in the immigration tribunal, for example. And we've noticed certain kind of gaps in the system, for basically, and we're trying to do different, to take different actions to try to kind of solve this issue. So in terms of litigation, friend, at the moment, when someone lacks litigation capacity and can't litigate in the immigration tribunal, for example, if they have a pending appeal on their asylum, there is currently no mechanism for them to obtain a litigation friend to assist them, which means a lot of the times their case just gets stuck and it can't be resolved. So what we've done in the project is that we've recruited professionals like Amy here, barristers, solicitors, social workers, and we train them up so that we can match them as litigation friends. And the idea is to kind of gather more expertise and document instances where the immigration system is basically inaccessible at the moment for people with mental health issues who lack litigation capacity.
That's great. So when we talk about litigation, that means taking something to trial?
Yes. So usually what happens is when an asylum seeker, for example, claim asylum, or a migrant makes an application to the Home Office then will decide whether or not to grant that person a particular status, whether it's refugee or some kind of a leave to remain based on their human rights, for example. If the Home Office decides not to grant them, then in some situations, including in asylum cases, the person will be able to appeal the decision, to challenge the decision in the tribunal. So that is a litigation against the Home Office in the tribunal.
That's great. Thanks, Brian. We're now going to talk to Amy, who's going to share her thoughts on how being a litigation friend works. So, Amy, you are a litigation friend with the MMCA project. What is a litigation friend and why is the role so important?
So essentially, the litigation friend is someone that can help somebody that doesn't have capacity with their immigration case. So sort of Brian was explaining, when somebody is going through the immigration process, they will make an application to the Home Office, and the Home Office will either decide in their favour that they should be allowed to stay in the UK, or against them, that they shouldn't be allowed to stay. And in general, people mostly go to the tribunal if they say, no, you can't stay in the UK, to see if a judge will make a different decision. But in order to do that, most people hopefully will be represented by a lawyer, a solicitor or a barrister, to help them in that process. But for somebody who doesn't have capacity, then they can't do what we call instruct their legal representative. So a legal representative will give somebody advice. So they will explain the process to them, and they will give them advice on the best way to proceed, or give them options on the ways that they can proceed. But they can't decide what to do for the person, for their client. That decision has to be made by the client themselves. Or if only one option is available, they have to consent to that being the way that they go forward. So if they lack capacity, if they can't understand that, if they can't understand the advice, or if they can't understand it sufficiently to consent or make a decision, then they need somebody else to help them to do that. And that's where a litigation friend comes in. So for example, it can be, you still want the client to be able to understand as much as possible. So it's not that the litigation friend steps in and makes a decision for them. In the cases that I've dealt with, we've still tried to very much explain the process to the client, tried to get them to understand as much as they possibly can, and to get them to make decisions on things that they can. So some people will be able to understand parts of the process and not other parts. And so try to keep the client as engaged as possible. But if they simply, if it gets to a point where they just can't make the decision, then the litigation friend can step in and make that decision on their behalf. So what you're doing is you're looking at what's the best interest of the client. You're probably asking questions that maybe the client would ask if they did understand the process, to make sure that to make sure you understand, and to make sure the solicitor's acting in the best interest of the client.
So you're somebody who's taking the best interests of the client at heart, and you're being slightly more assertive than, say, a solicitor might be able to be, in that you're proactively asking questions and making decisions where the client isn't necessarily able to.
Yes. So in terms of the question ask, it's just to make sure that, because the client might ask some questions. And so in things, for example, about consent, so there can be decisions, but there can also be consent. So somebody might have to disclose some information to the tribunal or to the Home Office about their case. And that might be quite sensitive information. And so they might need, the solicitor will need consent to see if the client would, is happy for that information to go before a judge. But they might not understand the implications of that. So for then it's important for me to ask the possible implications of that information, the pros and cons of us putting that information, and then look at whether it's in the best interest of the client for that to go before the judge or not.
I just want to say, I had a good example about that actually in another case in the project. So the client is an asylum seeker who's LGBT and also suffers from a lot of mental health issues. And then the case is about whether, if sent back to his country of origin, he would face persecution because of both aspects, basically, his mental health conditions and also his sexuality. And I think one of the issue in the case was that the judge wasn't sure whether or not his family would be accepting of his sexuality and also his mental health. So then the judge kind of recommended to the solicitor to kind of contact the family basically and get a statement from the family. So then that's something that, you know, the solicitor advised the client, and obviously the solicitor was saying, look, I can do this for you, but then it might mean I will be disclosing certain facts about your life, your disability or your mental health that your family might not be aware of, for example. So decisions like that, the solicitor can't take for the client, or it'll just put them in a very awkward position. And that's where kind of litigation friends then becomes helpful. And becomes not just helpful, very important when the client can't make that decision for themselves.
I mean, there's many different ways that people can lack capacity, as sort of Brian was saying earlier. So, you know, I've dealt with cases where people have had a brain injury, so they just don't have the cognitive ability to understand the process. And they can understand elements of it, but there are more complicated aspects that they might not be able to understand. And there can also who's had memory issues. And so simply the main issue was that they couldn't remember what had happened from one meeting to the next. And so I was there to help aid them with their memory and to make sure that they remembered that they what decisions they'd made, and sort of to assist them in that way, because otherwise the solicitor just couldn't get anywhere because he couldn't remember what was happening from one week to the next.
So, Amy, in your day job, you are a barrister. Could you briefly tell us how your role in the courtroom is different as a barrister compared to as a litigation friend?
Yes. So as a barrister, I'm taking instructions from the clients. So most of my clients, even though quite a lot of my clients are vulnerable, most of them will have capacity to instruct me. Most of them, I'm able to explain the process in a simpler enough way for them to understand the process and to engage and make decisions. So in those cases, I will be taking instructions from the client and then representing their case as best as I can to the judge. But as a litigation friend, I'm there for the client. So I'm trying to, so it will be somebody who can't give instructions or cannot always give instructions to the legal representative. So they will have a legal representative as well. And if they struggle to give those instructions at the court hearing, then I can do that on their behalf. I can decide what's in their best interest. So I generally won't be speaking. I won't always be speaking to the judge myself when I'm a litigation friend. I'm mostly just there to support the client and to make sure they understand everything. And if they don't, that decisions are made in their best interests.
That's really helpful. Thank you. I think it would be clarifying to just get our heads around the tribunal system for a second. A tribunal is a slightly more informal courtroom.
Yes. So, yes, you would call the judges are called sir and madam. They're generally not, if you're thinking of a courtroom in terms of criminal courts, which is what most people see on television, where the judge is sitting really high up. Normally the judge is more on a level with the client. Everyone's sitting down, and it's supposed to be a much less formal process. You don't have to swear to tell the truth on a Bible, or you need to tell the truth in the tribunals. They expect you to tell the truth, but it's less formal in that respect.
Thank you for clearing that up, Amy. Why did you choose to become a litigation friend? What have you learned from it?
So I initially became involved, and Brian sort of contacted me because I volunteered for them for a number of years to support people. And when Brian was sort of starting up the project, he sort of contacted me to see if I would be interested. And I had been aware of the issues of getting litigation friends appointed in the immigration tribunal setting. So there has been a legal case where it says that you can have a litigation friend in the tribunal, but there's normally you would have a procedure for that. So in the tribunal, there's quite a lot of procedural rules and guidance about different subjects, but there wasn't and isn't about litigation friends. And so even though that there is a case that you can rely on to say my client doesn't have capacity, the upper tribunal has said that litigation friends should be appointed. How you actually do that is very difficult. So there's that issue of getting a litigation friend appointed, but also there's just the issue of who can be a litigation friend. So in some circumstances, it's simpler that there may be a relative or a friend who can act in that capacity. But the solicitor has to check to make sure that there's no conflict of interest. So because the litigation friend has to act in the best interests of the client, they can't really have any interest in the case. So if they're also making an application for leave to remain, for example, it may be that at some point their case conflicts with the client's case, or you're not sure if it will. And so then they stop being somebody who's able to represent or who's able to be a litigation friend. Or it could be that some people in the immigration context, they've come to the UK alone, they don't know anyone, they haven't made any close friends that would be able to support them in that way, particularly someone who maybe they may have friends, but they may not feel comfortable coming to a tribunal. For example, if they don't have status themselves, they're probably not that willing to come to a tribunal voluntarily to assist somebody else. And so some people just don't have anyone in their lives who could act in that way. And so I'd seen the struggles in finding people sometimes to do that role in individual cases. And so sort of when Brian said that they were starting this project, I could see how valuable it could be. Because if you don't have a litigation friend and you don't have capacity to instruct a solicitor, then there's a real roadblock, because the solicitor can't do anything without your instructions. The solicitor can't make decisions for you. And so the decision about when you get a decision, if you get a decision from the Home Office, there's a decision of whether you want to appeal that decision. You may have capacity to understand that you want to do that because you want to stay in the country, but then there are more decisions to be made. And so you come to a point where the solicitor can't do anything more for you, and it just has to keep asking for the case to be put back and put back until there's somebody that can assist and can be a litigation friend. And that delay can be really detrimental to people. So, for example, there can be cases, I've had a case where somebody didn't have leave to remain. And if you don't have leave to remain, you don't have access to services, you don't have access to public funds. And so if you are a very vulnerable person with mental health issues or physical health issues, you need some kind of support. And that if you're having to adjourn your case for a long time, for in this case, I think it was around 2 years, then, you know, you can lose the access to services you had, which means you might go into rent arrears, as happened. Somebody might try and evict you. You only have access to certain medical treatment, any emergency medical treatment. You may then be charged for that. So all of the hostile environment sort of means that these people can be made even more vulnerable because they can't access the services that they need during the time that they're waiting for the appeal. It's not always the case. Some people do have leave to remain whilst they're waiting, but for those that don't, and even for those that do, it's very unsettling for people to have to wait such a long time to have a decision on their case, because all that time they're sort of in limbo waiting to see whether they'll be allowed to stay in the UK or not.
So, Amy, you were talking about conflicts of interest. I wondered if you could give us an example from your experience to just help us understand what that might look like.
In some applications, people have to prove that they're dependent upon somebody in order to be successful in their application. And often that's a family member, and they might also then be the only person that could be their litigation friend that they know. But that could be a conflict because, for example, if the person who they were dependent upon wasn't so keen on having somebody dependent on them for for long periods of time, then they may not always act in the client's best interest if they feel that they're not entirely sure that they want the application to succeed. And then there also might just be cases where people haven't disclosed information to their family members, particularly I'm thinking of asylum cases and particularly sensitive issues such as maybe LGBT issues or issues where there has been some violence or sexual violence. Often people haven't told their family members. And so if that person is acting as their litigation friend, they will have to disclose that information to that family member, and that might not be something they're comfortable with. And so they may either just not say things that they should, that they need to disclose in order to win their case, or they might just not be able to do that in front of the litigation friend. So they're just not the right person, the appropriate person to act in that way.
What happens when somebody needs a litigation friend but doesn't have one?
Well, hopefully they live in London and hopefully they can engage in our project. Hopefully their solicitor is aware of the project and refers them, and then Brian can find somebody to act as their litigation friend, because the other options, well, there just really aren't any. There is, in other areas of law, you have what's called an official solicitor. And so in some of the cases that I deal with children in other areas of law, we can just ask the official solicitor and they will appoint somebody, and they are the person that acts as their litigation friend. But that doesn't happen in the tribunal. I think they don't have the capacity or the ability to represent people in the tribunals. And so the official solicitor is supposed to be the person of last resort. And so if they're not there and the project wasn't there, then there potentially would be no one, and the client's potentially languishing for unknown periods of time, for an indefinite period of time.
Yeah, that's the gap actually, Luke, that I was referring to at the beginning. Because the official solicitor is actually kind of part of the Ministry of Justice, basically. They're kind of very much connected to the Ministry of Justice. So they're a government department. And then one of their roles, as Amy said, is to become a litigation friend of last resort. So they act kind of regularly in I think, family court, right? High court and the court protection. But in the tribunal system, as far as I know, in the entire tribunal system, like employment tribunal, for example, and including immigration tribunal, they're just not acting at the moment. So we have actually met with the official solicitor a couple of times in the past. And they keep on saying, you know, the reason behind that is because they don't have the capacity, ironically, to act in the immigration tribunal or any other tribunal system, because they don't have enough caseworkers to handle these cases and that sort of thing. But, you know, as a result, there's just a gap basically at the moment.
And what happens if they don't live in London?
There isn't another service that I'm aware of. I don't know if Brian is. To the point that I know that Brian has, he's probably better to speak about me, that Brian has contacts with the Home Office. And sometimes our clients get moved. So if they're particularly asylum clients, they will be given accommodation and they can be moved to anywhere in the UK. If they try and move somebody who's within the project, then Brian will be a reason for them not moving out of London, because if they move out of London, they don't have their litigation friend anymore. And so I think the Home Office, that shows that the Home Office are aware that this is the only project acting in the way that it does. Like Brian probably knows more about this.
Yeah, I've been trying to find alternative places where we can signpost, basically, because we're also quite a small project. We have around 20 to 25 litigation friends. And then everyone's, you know, a professional as well, because we're trying to maintain like a high standard, essentially. So then we can only take in so many cases. And we're not statutory service. We're not properly funded for that. So you know, on top of doing this, you'll also keep on pushing and trying to push the government to either fund the official solicitor or come up with a better solution that could really respond to the demands, basically, because we think that there's probably quite a lot of cases out there that we don't know about, especially outside of London.
And just from my perspective, it's quite time consuming as a litigation friend. You have to put in quite a lot of time. So you need to attend all of the appointments with the legal representative. That's obviously normally in working hours. And I also, you know, I also have a full-time job. So sort of fitting that in, and I'm self-employed, so I can ask, you know, I can take time out to do it. But that is obviously a loss. You know, if I'm doing that, then I'm not earning money. I'm not going to court. So it does, I can only really take on one case at a time as a litigation friend. And I think that's probably similar for most people in this role, because we are all professionals. We do all have other jobs. And we have to go to all the appointments, as I said, and then contact the client in between times to make sure they're okay, to make sure that they don't have any questions about their case, to make sure they have an understanding as much as they can of what's going on. It's time consuming. So it just means that it's not as if there are unlimited resources within the project itself. Generally people can just take on one case at a time, I think. And yeah, they can go on for a long time, because appeals can sometimes take a long time to be listed anyway. And they take time to prepare, so it can be quite a process.
Sure. So why does the gap only exist in the tribunal system?
Well, I think that Brian was sort of mentioned about the lack of capacity with the official solicitor. I think there's probably two factors. One is that we probably have, I don't know because I don't work in other areas, but we probably do have more clients that probably have smaller networks or no network at all, because the nature of, for example, somebody who's come here to claim asylum, they generally have come on their own, not with their family members. And so they don't have somebody to who they can ask. Whereas maybe sort of in employment tribunal, you might have lived in the UK your whole life and you might have somebody who is able to, you know, a friend or a family member. And there's probably less chance, I imagine, in the employment tribunal, for example, that your family member is going to have an interest, a conflict of interest with your employment case. And so I think the factors are twofold in the immigration tribunal. One, that it's probably more difficult to find somebody who can be their litigation friend. And then together with the fact that the official solicitor doesn't have capacity to be that person of last resort.
I feel like, because by definition, you're also talking about people with mental health issues, and then also a lot of asylum seekers who face persecution back home and a lot of trauma as well. So really, really vulnerable people who might not even speak English, for example. So then it's just really hard for them to kind of build that kind of support and connection in the UK, especially with the hostile environment and detention and all of these other aspects.
And probably the people that those people will meet will be people that are in a similar situation to them, who even if they've got capacity, maybe just don't have the ability or, you know, to act as their litigation friend. They might not have English as a first language. They might, you know, there's probably other barriers to the people they meet.
Yeah. And I think the issue in immigration is also a bit more difficult. I don't know whether you agree, Amy, compared to like other tribunal, because I'm thinking like employment tribunal, for example. I mean, I guess discrimination cases can be quite tricky, but because, you know, we are talking about persecution and like sensitive issues, you know, around torture, for example, traumatic experiences, sometimes involving family members, sexual orientation. It's just, yeah, all the decisions are just much kind of weightier, I would think.
Yeah, I would agree. I'd agree that there are probably a lot of issues that are sensitive that people struggle to, vulnerable clients struggle to kind of tell their account of what's happened to them anyway to a Home Office official, and in cases that I've had with vulnerable clients, even when they've had capacity, it can take several meetings before they feel comfortable to completely explain their story, what's happened to them. And so to have to do that in front of a family member or even a close friend may be really difficult. And yeah, and also the consequences of somebody not getting proper legal representation in asylum or immigration cases, particularly in asylum, is that they are returned to a country where they face persecution. But even in deportation cases, for example, they could be removed from sort of the only life they've known for many years. And particularly if they do have sort of mental and physical health problems, how they're going to cope if they're returned to their country of origin without the support, without sort of the services that they have here.
Yeah, I mean, Brian, you talked about people needing to relive traumatic experiences. What level of detail does the Home Office ask for?
Very detailed, I would say. Like, unnecessarily detailed sometimes, I would think. Because I think substantive interview, your long interview with the Home Office can kind of span hours and sometimes even days, I think. And it do try to kind of go into a lot of details. So I think in LGBT cases, for example, I've heard some of our members talk, recounting how they were asked like their sexual position, for example, to kind of show that they are LGBT, which is really inappropriate, but that kind of like the level of details that sometimes the Home Office would ask people.
Yeah. I think because often when people are fleeing persecution, they don't, they're not able to provide a lot of documentary evidence about their situation. And so often it is entirely based on, but in many cases, it can be entirely based on whether their account is believed or not, because they just don't have any documentary evidence to corroborate it. And so the questions, so there can be a lot of questions both at the interview stage and then also questions, some of the asylum appeals that I've attended, that the questioning has gone on for an hour or two. So the details there. So it is a lot of detail, and they are basically trying to prove that they're telling the truth, and the Home Office are trying to, show that they're, often people are refused asylum on the basis that they're not believed, their account isn't believed. So the Home Office are trying to test their evidence to see if they're, to look at inconsistencies or things that are implausible.
So what is the system that's being used? Do you have a courtroom with a prosecution and a defence? Are the Home Office trying to argue they aren't telling the truth?
So in court proceedings, so it will start off, in the tribunal proceedings, there will be a witness statement. So the legal representatives of the appellant, the client, the person who's claiming asylum or asking for leave to remain, they would have written hopefully a very detailed witness statement setting out their case. And also that witness statement will often respond to the refusal letter. So when you get a refusal letter, it has the reasons why they've refused you. So the witness statement is also supposed to deal with the reasons that they've refused you. So basically, the role of the person representing the client in the hearing initially will just be to ask them to confirm that their witness statement is true. And then that's when the Home Office asks questions. So they are then testing the evidence, putting their case to the client. So their case, if their case is that they're not telling the truth, they sort of need to put all the things that they think suggest that they're not telling the truth to the client to see if they can offer an explanation about it. There might be other witnesses, and then you have all the documentary evidence. So at the end, the Home Office, the person representing the Home Office, will say, "This is why." Will say to the judge why they think that the appeal should be dismissed, so why the person shouldn't be allowed to stay in the UK, and then the client's representative, the appellant's representative, will tell the judge why they think that the client should be allowed to stay in the UK, and why they think they are telling the truth, or why they think they meet the rules, whatever the case may be. And then the judge makes a decision, normally goes away, writes their decision down, and sends that to you.
So what you're describing sounds like an incredibly intense experience where people have their trauma picked through by a very hostile government body. And in most of the country, there isn't any support for people with potentially very serious mental health needs or who lack capacity in other ways. And so they face this potentially very horrible experience without having a litigation friend. Is that a good summary?
I mean, I think that the litigation friend is there because otherwise that person... So the person will hopefully have a lawyer, and they will hopefully have a good lawyer who represents them well. And so if they don't lack capacity... If they have a good lawyer, hopefully they will be able to sort of mitigate some of the harshness of having to repeat their story. But of course, it is traumatic. And for some people, it's so traumatic that that they can't actually give evidence. So in some cases, I've had clients that just can't actually be cross-examined. But you really need what we call a medico-legal report. So a report from a psychiatrist, normally, to say that they can't cope with being questioned, and then you need to think of other ways. But the real purpose of the litigation friend is because it's a stressful experience. I think anybody would find it stressful to have to recount their trauma, or even just stressful, even if you're not recounting trauma, just if you're having to just talk about your life in intimate detail like that, it's stressful. And if you're somebody doesn't believe you, that's a stressful situation to be in. And so the litigation friend is sort of just it's even worse if you lack capacity and you just don't actually understand what's happening in the hearing. And so with a litigation friend, hopefully we're able to sort of just explain a bit what's happening, hopefully try and help them to understand why the Home Office aren't asking the questions, that's their job. The case is that the Home Office don't believe them, and their job is to test that, so they don't think that like it's a personal attack on them or something like that, to try and help them understand the process a bit, and understand that the judge is independent, and the judge will hopefully make a fair decision based on all of the information, and isn't going to just accept what the Home Office say, that they're actually separate. So sort of understanding that hopefully helps somebody to feel a little bit less stressed about the situation.
And I feel like making that decision as well as to when it would just be worse to kind of give any kind of evidence, I guess, because that is like one decision that you need to instruct a solicitor on, when to kind of request to the tribunal and saying, no, there's, there can't be any questioning from the Home Office and this sort of thing. Because, in some cases, people do want to actually talk a little bit or kind of like be involved in the process. But obviously, as Amy said, like the kind of personal recount is really important in a lot of these cases. I feel like there's kind of like a strategic decision there to be made, basically, like whether or not to give evidence and whether it will be so terrible that the person would just be, it's just not going to be in the best interest of the person. And if the person lacks mental capacity, then they won't be able to kind of talk about that or like discuss that with the solicitor properly and instruct them properly. And that's where the litigation friend needs to step in and kind of make that decision.
Yeah, and I think that's right, because it may be quite difficult for them. So if you don't give evidence and you don't have a medical report to say that you just can't give evidence, you lack the capacity to give evidence, or it would be too traumatizing for you, then the Home Office in that situation, the judge in that situation can draw an adverse inference. So if you don't, if you're able to give evidence and you don't, then the judge can consider why that might be, and they might think that's because you're not telling the truth, for example.
Yeah.
And so that can be quite a difficult concept for somebody to understand. So if they lack capacity, so as Brian said, a solicitor can't make that decision. They can just advise. And so a client may really not understand and may just be like, I don't want to give evidence because it's going to be too stressful. But helping them to understand or making that final decision, because weighing up the adverse inference versus the harm for them and the harm for their case if they do give evidence.
So you mentioned you can get a medical report, which sounds like a very useful document to have. What are the obstacles to getting a report like that?
Funding.
Funding, yeah.
The cost of it. Because in order to persuade the tribunal that you need a litigation friend, normally you would probably need some medical evidence to say why a litigation friend would be needed. And so getting that initial report can be difficult. Sometimes people are already in sort of mental health services and they're able to, you know, you're able to get information from the support services that they're already involved with to show that they lack capacity. Well, the solicitor is able just to tell that they lack capacity. I mean, if they were in a coma, for example, then we would then it's pretty clear that they lack capacity. But also for somebody who's been through a traumatic experience, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that people who have suffered trauma don't recount their history chronologically sometimes, and that can sometimes be seen as they're lying because they've got dates out of order, or you know, some people just can't talk about certain aspects or have a complete memory block of certain really traumatic events. And so in those circumstances, getting you can also get a medical legal report in those circumstances just to show that somebody to diagnose them with PTSD, for example, and that's potentially the reason why they haven't been able to recall all the events that happened to them, or they haven't been able to recall them in chronological order. Or if they do have, say, a learning disability, which means that they potentially didn't understand all the questions in interview, and that's why they you know, they really tried to answer them, but maybe they don't make sense because they haven't really understood them because they have some learning disability, for example.
So we've talked about how important it is to have a litigation friend. Brian, how many people has the MMCA project helped so far?
So the project started in October 2017, so it's been 5 years now, actually. We've had about 95 cases so far, but 68 of them are still ongoing. Now, they're at like different stages, so among the 68, there are kind of cases which, in terms of immigration, it has been kind of resolved, but we're still working on them on other issues, like housing or benefits and things like that. But yeah, but that's roughly the amount of people we're working with.
And in your opinion, is what the project is doing enough to deal with the extent of the issue?
No, unfortunately. I mean, yeah, as I explained before, I think because the project is based in London and it is very much kind of London-based. And I think a lot of the work that the litigation friend has to do, like Amy explained before, really does have to be done in person, you know, especially when talking about people who are really vulnerable, have a lot of mental health issues. To encourage them to make decisions or understand the process, it doesn't really work remotely. So I think outside of London, there's still a lot of problem because there's no one we can signpost to. I've got a lot of referrals, for example, from charities or like from solicitors from outside of London where they're working with clients and people who need a litigation friend. But our project doesn't have any litigation friend in that area, for example, and I just can't, there's nowhere I can signpost to, essentially. So then what happens is usually the case, it's, you know, just gets adjourned, and then eventually a few months afterwards, they just come back again and again. until we have capacity, which is not, you know, obviously not the system, how the system should be.
Sure. And what do you think needs to be done to solve the issue?
So, yeah, I think this project is kind of like a band-aid, I would say. So we're trying to kind of, you know, do something to help as much as we can while trying to push for the system to be better. But it does need to be, there does need to be a system to deal with cases like this, to identify litigation friend of last resort for individuals who lack mental capacity to litigate. Because as we've discussed a lot, it is, you know, the decision in the immigration tribunal is really important and could carry really grave consequences for the appellant, especially when we're talking about asylum. So it's kind of, you know, it's of utmost importance that the individuals have a fair access to the courts. And there needs to be, I think the only solution is like there needs to be a government system to fill this gap, essentially. And it can't be left to kind of charities like Migrants Organize to try to fill a gap of, you know, the entire UK's immigration tribunal system. That is, yeah, it's not going to work. Basically that is why Migrants Organize is actually at the moment trying to bring the government, a legal challenge against the government about on this gap, because as mentioned before, we've met with representative from the Official Solicitor's Office, from the Ministry of Justice. We've talked to them a couple of times, raised these issues a number of times. And while they keep on saying that they are aware of this issue and that they're looking into it, it's also been 5 years of this project and we're seeing no end of this. There's no kind of proposals, for example, that the government has given out on how they're going to kind of start even looking into this issue or solving this issue. So at the moment, we've instructed a solicitor to represent us to potentially bring a claim against the government for their failure to implement a proper system to allow people with mental health issues and who lack capacity to access the immigration tribunals.
That sounds very exciting. If people listening want to help, how can they support?
With litigation, because usually in cases like this, in the UK, there's no kind of system of a class action like you see in the US television shows, where kind of a lot of individuals can just band together and bring a strategic claim like this. It either has to be the individual themselves or an organization like Migrants Organize. And obviously, in this case, the individuals can't do that because Migrants Organize is providing the solution. Where, you know, people like Amy are matched to our clients, so then they can proceed with the litigation. So then the only way we can challenge the government is by us, Migrants Organize as a charity, bringing the claim against the government. And this is called a judicial review challenge. And with judicial review challenge, there's always a cost risk, unfortunately. So if the kind of outcome of the case is not in favor of Migrants Organize, then we'll be asked to kind of pay for the cost of the Home Office and their legal representation. We will obviously ask for a cost capping order to kind of limit the amount, but it is still kind of like a big windfall for us. One of the things that people can do if they want to support is obviously donate, because we're going to be doing a crowdfunding to fundraise for this issue, for this challenge. But also, obviously, apart from that, it's also kind of like spreading the word about this issue, because it is quite technical and a bit niche and hard to understand. But it is also really important, and I think a lot more people should be aware of this issue.
If you succeed in your case, what will the result be?
So at the moment, we're at the stage where we've sent an initial pre-action protocol letter. That's kind of like the initial threatening letter, basically, where you say, sort this out or we'll take you to the court. We're still waiting for the response from the Ministry of Justice. We're hoping we don't need to go to the court and they will just kind of say, yes, we will do something about it. But if we do go to the court, then the court will probably decide whether there's like a public law error, whether there's been kind of an actual gap in the system at the moment, and then kind of ask the government to sort out this issue. So basically, yeah, the High Court won't be able to kind of tell the Ministry of Justice what system needs to be in place. But they can kind of ask them and tell them to sort something out, hopefully in consultation with charities like Migrants Organize and people on the ground who kind of who are familiar with this issue.
And just to clarify, the issue you're taking to court is the lack of litigation friends around the country.
Yes, lack of litigation friend of last resort in the immigration tribunals.
Well, this sounds like a really important case that's going to help thousands of people all over the country. Amy, just to close off, I wondered if we could get an example from you about the difference a litigation friend can make if you're going through the tribunal system.
I think the difference that it makes is that people's cases can actually be heard in the tribunal, because without one, then that's not going to happen. So when I was appointed in my first case, so quite soon after the project started, that client had been sort of waiting for quite some time to get to appeal stage because he just didn't have, because he didn't have a litigation friend, they couldn't go to the appeal. And so I said that meant that there was issues with his accommodation and access to services. And so by me being appointed as a litigation friend, we were able to get a court date. We were able to go before a judge and have his case heard. And I think it had been about 2 years that he'd been waiting. Mm. And so it was, I mean, that's the difference it makes, that without that, I don't know whether he'd have ever got to go to court, because he's without a litigation friend, he wouldn't have been able to have his case heard. And so that's the difference that makes. It's essentially very vulnerable people who need a decision from the courts in their case, because waiting can be incredibly stressful. And so without the litigation friend, the whole proceedings are stalled for an indefinite period of time. So the difference is that a vulnerable person will get before a judge and will have a fair opportunity to present their case to an independent judge rather than just the decision by the Home Office.
I'm so glad you mentioned waiting. I think if there's a through line going through all of our episodes that we've recorded so far, it's about how awful it can be waiting for a decision to be made and having nothing you can do about it. I guess this fits in with a wider theme about the work that Migrants Organise does, helping people organise and speak up for themselves.
Yeah.
Brian, have you got any final thoughts you'd like to share today?
I think we've covered pretty much all of it. Yeah, I agree with Amy. I think we're not different. This is quite a basic requirement, I would say. Like, everyone should be agreeing. Like, you know, people with mental health issues should be able to access the court. We're not demanding the sky here. And that's it. Like, people should be able to access the court fairly. And it's just not the case at the moment.
Okay, well, thank you both so much for talking to me today. Take care,
I'll see you soon.
Since the recording of this podcast, Migrants Organise has received a positive response on their legal challenge against the Ministry of Justice. They confirmed that, unlike before, the Office of the Official Solicitor will act in the Immigration Tribunal as a litigation friend of last resort to more migrants who lack mental capacity to litigate. This is a huge step forward in ensuring access to justice for many vulnerable migrants in the UK, and shows the positive change that can come about through community action and organising. As we have heard throughout this podcast, there are many other issues affecting migrants and asylum seekers under the current hostile environment agenda. Show your solidarity and get involved through Migrants Organise, Solidarity Knows No Border Network. Visit www.firmcharter.org.uk to find out more. If you are a lawyer or an advisor or know somebody who is facing difficulties finding a litigation friend of last resort in the Immigration Tribunal, please go to our website. Under Migrants Mental Capacity Advocacy Project, you will find resources to help you given this recent development. You can also email Brian, and his email is on the website. You have been listening to Losing Myself, Mental Health in a Hostile Environment. Today's show was brought to you by Migrants Organise, a platform for refugees and migrants to organise for power, dignity and justice to enable meaningful inclusion and integration. They combine advice and support for individuals affected by the hostile environment immigration policy with community organising, advocacy, research and campaigning to dismantle structural racism. The theme song for this episode is Conform or Be Cast Out by Of Moy Om.